Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I see you. Good morning. I'm Liz, and I am an alcoholic. Gee, I can't wait to get home and tell my husband that about this sex dream. Is he going to be surprised? If you're disappointed that you're not hearing Father Pete this morning, think how I feel. Man, I've had to, Jim talked about it Friday night. No, I've filled in for a lot of speakers over the years. And, you know, I'm one of those ones that he talked about. Liz, I've called everybody, and nobody will do it. It's like a guy calling you for a date. I've called everybody, and nobody will go out with me, will you? So Sunday night, when Floyd called me, and Floyd calls me periodically, we like to chat, and I was glad he called because last month my family had a surprise birthday party on me, and Floyd and sister came, and they gave me a gift certificate, and my husband and I went to Indianapolis and went to a show, and then we went out to dinner. So I said, oh, good, I get a thank you for the gift certificate. And he said, you're going to the convention Sunday? And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, I wonder if you'd help me out with something. And I said, oh, sure. And he said, I want you to speak Sunday morning. I went, oh, my God, Floyd. I said, I thought you wanted me to be a greeter. And after a half hour, I said, oh, my God, Floyd. You know, in AA, we try to say yes whenever possible, but wow. And as I was walking down here this morning, I was involved in politics for many years when I was drinking. And oh, but I got out of that. And where's Jim Wilson? He knows all about it. And we were the only Democrats left, aren't we, Jim? But anyhow, I came down to French Lick a lot to political functions. It was quite the place to come. And my youngest brother and I were here one summer, and I wore a partial plate at that time. And somewhere out there on that front lawn are those teeth. Because he and I crawled all around there looking for those teeth, and we never did find them. So I never thought that one Sunday morning I'd be standing before a group of alcoholics. Boy, the changes in our life. And I didn't tell my home group last Tuesday I was coming here to speak. I was afraid they want their money back. But my home group is the St. Morris group, which is located outside of Greensburg, Indiana. I've been a member of that group for 22 years. And some of my home group are here. Now, we've got a small group, so just about a fifth of them. And I'm going to introduce them this morning. George, stand up. Jerry, Patty, Donna and Phyllis and Wes and their Patty. And I said Jerry. You know I wouldn't forget Jerry. And you know, that's a big part of my sobriety is my home group. And that's where I go every week. And, you know, they put me in my place. And they also have been such a big support to me, especially these past few months. That's so hard. I'm losing my voice already. When I went out to the International Convention this summer, I told this story several times, and I'll share it again. But I love this little story this guy told at the intergroup luncheon. And he was talking about this guy was going to die, and he said to St. Peter, before I die, I'd like to join a church. So St. Peter took him around, and he took him to a Catholic church, and there was chanting and beautiful stained glass windows. I guess, I don't think so. So he took him to a Protestant church, and they were singing hymns, and they had on suits and ties, and I don't think so. So he took him by this other place and went by there, and there was people down in the basement, and they were drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, and they were laughing, and he said, Oh, I like that one. What's the name of that one? And he, St. Peter said, I don't know. They won't tell us who they are. And that's my St. Morris group. They're down in the basement. They're smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and laughing. And we're out in the country. We're real isolated. I also wanted to introduce my daughter this morning. Well, she thinks she's my daughter. Vicki, stand up. She goes around to conferences, and she's got people in Indianapolis convinced that she's my daughter. And I want to tell you, I've never been in a blackout with a Chinaman. I have a lot of Al-Anon friends here this morning, too. None of my family is in Al-Anon, but I had this one Al-Anon friend whose husband never sobered up. And when he died, she had him cremated. And she mixed these ashes up with some marijuana. And she rolled it up and smoked it. And I said, don't you feel bad? She said, heck no, that's the only time you ever made me feel good. Sister, is this the spiritual part? Okay, I got the part that says we're not a glum lot. You know, our book tells us that we're a group of people who normally wouldn't mix. And it's so true. It doesn't matter if we came here from Yale or jail or Park Avenue, park bench. Some of us saw the light and some of us felt the heat. We all got here because our lives had become unmanageable and we were powerless over alcohol. And that was the way it was with me. I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I did get in trouble, I had been drinking. And we talk about when a woman falls down drunk, we all laugh. But when a man falls down, we laugh. When a woman falls down, she's fallen from grace. Or so it was with me and my family. I also like to tell everybody I'm from the CIA, which means I'm a Catholic Irish alcoholic. And my Irish heritage comes through because I laugh easily and I cry easily. And I also, as some of you might know, I have a lot of trouble with my words. My R's and my W's. And my S's and what else? And Madonna's going to sit over there and your T's. But to give you an example, a few years ago I was the voice of the Indiana State Convention. And one of my duties was to announce things. And I said, if I have to announce that Wuff Weaver Roundup one more time. And those people invited me down to Wuff Weaver. And it was too rough. I had a heart attack and spent the weekend in the hospital. And my husband told our friend Jerry, said, now you look after her down there. And I was telling Jean that at breakfast this morning. And I said, well, I did break an ankle at one convention. And one convention I had a heart attack. And I think he thought I needed a nurse instead of a host. But, and I did want to thank him. I'm sorry. I did want to thank the committee and Jean and his wife. And I have enjoyed your company these last few days. So. And thank Floyd, I think. But I'll tell a couple more little stories about myself, and then I'll go on. I never drank anything unusual until I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous about 2 years. And I heard people talk about drinking gasoline through a cheesecloth, and they drink an aftershave lotion. Lady said she put vodka in her steam art. Well, I was about 2 years sober, and we just moved into this house, and my husband had a lot of stomach problems, and he would buy Melanta by the case. And so there was one bottle by itself, so I just put it up on the medicine cabinet, And I went in. I woke up one night with a stomachache, and I got up and I went in the bathroom and I got that bottle down. I said, take 2 tablespoons. You know, I took 4. And I went back in, got in bed, and I got back up. And by that time, he was in there. And I said, how do you stand this stuff? And he went, that's my transmission fluid. He poured it into the Melanta bottle. He always told everybody he had to call the doctor when to change my oil and check my dipstick. And we were down in that. And things haven't gotten any better either. We were down in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had been in the bathroom and brushed my teeth, and I came out, and he had some medical problems, and he'd put some stuff in the wash basin. So there was a little cup with some water in it, and so I took my pill, and he went, you drank my peroxide. I'm standing there in this foam ball. So, some things just don't get any better. And back during those years, I had this real bleach, blonde, bouffant hair that was so stiff it looked like it'd break if I fell down. And but I had a brown streak right here. And people would ask me what that was. Well, what it was, when I would drink, I would sit with my drink like this and my cigarette up my hand. And after I sobered up, that little streak all went away. Our book tells us to tell in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I'll share a little bit of that with you this morning. I think, I don't know if it was Jim or maybe it was Kenny last night said, you know, that's what we're here for, to carry the message. And if we can't identify with the problem, how are we ever going to identify with the solution? So, and I think it's important that, you know, in the beginning, that's all I had to share was a little drunkalogue. But after I got into the program and the steps and working with others and working in service, that I began to have something else to share. And it tells us, you know, that we couldn't envision our life with or without alcohol. We had come to our jumping off place. And that was where I was at. I became so depressed, and then I became so desperate. And I was a blackout drinker. I grew up in the city of Indianapolis. I was the 4th of 5 children. And I had a sister and 2 brothers that were 10, 12, 14 years older than me. And then when I was about 10, my mother had another baby, my brother Jake. And my grandmother came to live with us. And so I got a lot of love and a lot of attention. I was very protected and very sheltered by these older brothers and sister and my grandmother. And my parents were both alcoholics. My dad worked on the railroad, the Monon, which is all around here in this place. He worked on the Monon Railroad, and my mother worked for the government. And they would work. They were functioning drunks like a lot of us. They worked every day, but they'd come home, we'd have dinner, and then they'd go down to the neighborhood tavern. And that was their lifestyle. And on Sundays, in those years, taverns weren't open, so the railroaders always came to our house because we lived close to the yards, and they would play cards, and they would drink. And I didn't like this atmosphere. I didn't like the way they acted. I didn't like the way they talked, the way they smelled. So my escape was to go off to the Sunday afternoon movies. And I loved the movie stars and the movie magazines. They all had blonde hair, and they were tanned and busty. And so I was about 13 years old, and I'd saved a little money. So they set stuff in the magazines that you could send away for that would make your hair grow and your bust. And they also said that you could pour beers through your hair and it would make it lighter. So Mother and Daddy always kept a case of bottled beer on the back porch. So I had the stuff came and I got the beer and I poured it in my hair. I rubbed this stuff in my hair. It looked like Vic Sad. And then I rubbed it on the brush again. And I went out and I laid in the sun. Well, of course, all I got was a bad sunburn. And my parents had the awfulest argument because each one accused the other one of drinking the beer, and there wasn't any way I could have told them I'd drink it. I mean, poured it in my hair. I didn't drink it. And But, and of course, that stuff didn't work. It took me days to get that washed out of my hair. Now, the bush cream took about 5 years. But maybe it was my... I had one brother who was a page in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and when he graduated from Page Boy High School, he went off to the service, and he was killed during the invasion of Italy, and maybe it was because my parents were dealing with their own grief that summer that they opened up our home to my dad's younger brother, and it was a small house, and it was crowded. There was like four adults and my little brother and I. And my dad's brother came home from the service, and he supposedly had been injured. I think in the war, I think all happened, he fell out of bed during a bombing raid. But anyway, they did let him come and stay. And he made some improper sexual advances to me. And as I told you, I was very protected and sheltered. So my way to handle it was to go next door and stay at the neighbor's house. And I would stay there and play with the little girl next door till mother and daddy had come home from work. And one day this little girl came over to get me, and he made the same approach towards her. And she went home and she told. My father was very abusive to my mother when he drank. Now, he wasn't to me, but he was to mother. And so, of course, the parents called mine, and they sent me down to stay with my brother for a week. And when I came back, my mother, she always called me Elizabeth, and she said, "Elizabeth, why didn't you tell me about this?" And I said, "Because I was afraid that if I told you, that Daddy would take it out on you." And she was covered with bruises and black eyes. And so, you know, when they talk about this being a family disease, I'm sure that it is. I grew up with a lot of resentments towards my dad. And I can remember as a little girl standing at the top of the stairs and crying when Daddy and Mother would argue, and Grandma would say, "Come and get in bed with me and put the covers up over your head, and we won't have to listen to it." And it's hard to believe that little girl who stood up there and cried would grow up to become this raging alcoholic who later on would get into arguments with the police and everything. But the one thing I have to say about my dad and my mother, they worked hard, and my dad had to do hard physical work, and it would have been hard for a young, healthy man, but my dad was a partial cripple who'd had untreated polio as a child, and they taught us to be honest and to have good morals and to work hard, and for that I'm grateful. And it was only through working a thorough fourth and fifth step that I was able to let go of all these old childhood resentments. And I still never tell this part, but I try to tell this morning. as I told you, the railroaders always came to the house to play cards, and most of the men were always my dad's age. I graduated from high school when I was 17 and went to work for the telephone company, and I was about 18 years old. Well, there was another young man who would come to the house with him, and he was like about 26 years old, and it was obvious that he was coming to see me. And he eventually asked me to go out against my parents' objections. I did, and I'd never had a relationship before. And I'd had boyfriends, but that was about it. And it was very obviously that he was becoming very interested in me. And my parents were objected because he drank too much, they said. And mother said, "He drinks a lot for a young man." Just as I got older, drank. And but within a short time, we did get married. And I found out that I had not only jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. He had a serious drinking problem, and he had some very, very serious psychological problems. They may have been unresolved war injuries, I don't know. But we had a child the first year, and we had a child the second year, and he worked on the railroad with my dad, and one night I came home, and the fire department was there carrying the children out of the house. The neighbors had seen the house, the smoke coming out, and he passed out, and there were some other things happened, and he was drinking, and a man was killed, and my brother came up, and he posted the bond, and my dad went to the railroad board. And eventually he was incarcerated and had spent some time. And before he went off, we were divorced, and he remarried, and I remarried, and I had these little children, and that was when I married Clarence. And when he got out of prison, he never attempted to see the children, and my sister had tried a few times to have some kind of contact with the children. And a few years ago, I asked my oldest son, I said, "Have you ever had any regrets that you didn't have a relationship with him?" And he said, "Mother, the only father figure I've ever had is Clarence." And Clarence and I had a child, and he went to on the Indianapolis Police Department, and Clarence drank, didn't he, Jim? Jim was the bartender. And back when Jim first saw us around AA, he thought we were here because of my husband. And all my family drank. My parents, my brothers, my sister, their spouses. I was the only one in the family that truly didn't drink very much. And I don't know what happened, but I started to go to work. And I was, as I said, I'd worked in politics and I worked a lot of political jobs. And we began to stop after work and have a drink. And I looked forward to stopping and having that drink. And then it became a habit, and I found myself not coming home and staying later. And as with all problems like that, we had other problems come up, and we were divorced. And after that, I left and I went into selling real estate, and I became involved in a relationship with a man there in Indianapolis that had a lot of political influence. And I only tell this as part of my story because it's so much a part of my alcoholism and how I got to AA. And this relationship was to go on for many years. We were never married. We never lived together. But he was very possessive and very jealous and very abusive. And he hardly drank at all. Probably the only person in my life I've ever been with that didn't drink much. And one night I was at the KSC. It was in February, and I had my youngest son with me, and we were celebrating our birthdays. And my son was about 8 or 9 years old, and my boy, he really did bring me a drink. Thank you.
I never ordered one drink.
The first one. Okay. So, but my sister, my son's father came and picked him up, and my sister said, "Liz, I think you better go home. It's starting to get pretty bad out." It was February, and I had on big high heels. I got home, and this man forced me into his car and took me to the edge of town, and as I told you, he was very abusive, and I attempted to open the car door, and when I did, my hand was caught in the door, and it almost pulled these 2 fingers off. And I walked back home that night in the freezing rain and called my brother Jake. And Jake was an alcoholic, and Jake and I, my brother, we drank together and we went to bars and we danced. And he came and took me to the hospital. I had to have a lot of surgery on my hand. So that I had told my mother, I said, "Oh, I think maybe I'll do something about my drinking now." And mother had stopped drinking because she'd had a lot of heart problems, and that was to be my first contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. And mother died very suddenly, and I stayed sober through the wake. And somehow I got in maybe 60, 90 days. And that was sort of become a pattern. I'd drink, and I'd stay sober. Something happened with him, and you know how we drink at people. And so there was one more incident, and then I'll move along with that. He had caused me to lose the sale that I had been anticipating, and I had a little bit to drink that night, and I went to his house, and I pulled up behind the house, and he came out, and I attempted to run over him, and the lady next door came out screaming. And you know, when I saw him there before me in the headlights, I thought, with all the bitterness, all the anger, I couldn't take it in my heart to take someone else's life. And the policeman pounded my car and took the beer out and sent me home in a cab. And I don't know if my heart took me back to A next day, but my feet sure did. And my oldest son said, Mother, I don't care what you do, but you just got to do something. So I went up to the club, and there was a man up there that I had to be on sick leave for a while, and his name was Jim, and his Kennedy, and that was a good Irish name, and Jim and I became good friends, and I sort of felt like he was my sponsor. So we were sharing and talking, and then something else happened with this guy, and I, that's when my son told me I should do something. And the one thing I knew, this man wouldn't follow me. I knew he wouldn't leave Indiana. So I went up to the club, and Jim says, Liz, I'm going to go out to Oregon and go in business with my son. You can come go with me. You stay a week, a month, a year, whatever it takes. And Mother had left me a little money, so it was enough to get out there. And so we got in, he got in the car, my car, and Jim and I drove off into the sunset. Well, we had decided that we had fallen in love. And then we decided that we would get married. And then we got drunk. Well, I didn't know anything about this man. And I found, I had about 8 months sobriety, and I think he had about 8 days. And then we got drunk. And it was probably after that, for both of us, the progression was so great. My youngest boy had stayed behind in Indianapolis with his father, and we both began to drink, and we went into business with his son. And there, one night, Jim, I found out after I married him, he didn't have a driver's license. He had two ex-wives looking for him. He had a felony against him. He had to get permission from the state of Indiana even to go out there. I should have known when he got in the car, that little shopping bag, that maybe he didn't have a great deal. So, the son and him got into it, and he fired him, but he kept me. And Jim would go out, and he'd look for a job, and he'd come home, and he did have very serious health problems. He'd had two major heart attacks. Well, one night, he sent me out to get something to drink, and I had on my house coat, and these great big purple fuzzy slippers. Well, I don't know if you've ever been in Oregon, but it rains all the time. So I had my rain coat on over my house coat, and I went out to the liquor store, and I was coming back, and I saw this light up there, and they pulled me over, and they said, lady, get out and walk that line. And I had on these big purple slippers. And then, you know what happened? I got arrested. But as I said, Jim, he'd been fired, and he'd stayed, looked for a job. And anyway, I come home one night, and his son come up and said, I hate to tell you this, but Dad took the money out of the bank, and he's going to New Jersey. And as always, my sister, she rescued me throughout my life. She and her husband came out there, and they helped me drive across the country, and I went to New Jersey. And we picked right back up with the drinking. We tried AA out in Oregon. We tried it in New Jersey. So I thought, well, this AA stuff isn't working. I'm going to go to an alcohol rehab as an outpatient. And what they did there was give me antabuse. And they told me all the things I shouldn't do with the antabuse. And I don't know what happened. But around Thanksgiving, I just went completely berserk. And they had to admit me in the middle of the night to a mental hospital. And they kept me sedated for about 3 days. And when I woke up, I was in a straitjacket. And I said to the orderly who was sitting next to the bed, I said, why am I in this straitjacket? And he said, because, lady, when we brought you in here the other night, you were screaming and pulling the hair out of the top of your head. And so eventually the psychiatrist came in to talk to me, and he said, when you checked in here, you had antabuse stuff. Have you ever had a problem with alcohol? And I said, well, I did drink a little bit. But I only took that so I didn't drink in front of my husband. And leave it. But they kept me in this ward, you know, and there weren't any doorknobs on the door, and the orderlies would light your cigarettes. And I wrote to my son, we'd go out and sit at this big table to eat, and I said, guess Mom's going to be like the rest of them with her head down the mashed potatoes. They eventually moved me off that ward and moved me into the alcohol. And I stayed there, but I was having some kind of seizures. And I continued to have them there in the clinic. And the insurance had run out, and it was time for me to leave. And the doctors come in, and he said, I don't think you ought to go home. I think you need further help. And we have someplace else we'd like to send you. And now, it's not nice like this, and it's an open ward, and you can sign yourself in. And I said, well, now, can I sign myself out? And they said, well, I don't know about that. And so I went back to my room, and I talked to this roommate of mine, and I told her, and she said, well, what's the name of it? And I told her, and she said, oh, you don't want to go there. That's a state hospital for the insane. And I've always been so grateful to that little lady, because I went home that night, and I probably had one of the worst seizures I'd ever had before. My sister and her husband had driven to New Jersey from Indiana, and they put me in another medical hospital, and they filled me with the yum-yums, you know, the Valiums and the Librams and all that. And eventually I was able to go back to work. I'd had a pretty decent job there in New Jersey because of my sales background, and I was taking the antabuse, and Jim was still drinking, and one night we stopped after work, and we stopped at a little bar, and I thought, well, I wonder how many days it's been. You know, I'd take the antabuse, and then I'd go off it, and I thought, well, I think it's been, I've been off of it long enough. So I ordered a drink. My face got so wet, and my heart was like it was jumping out of my skin. And he didn't know I took the antabuse. And so he gave me one of these nitroglycerin pills. So I sat there the rest of the night and drank. And, of course, I got very drunk and very, very sick. And that was to become a pattern. I'd take the antabuse, I'd go off, and I'd drink. And during the next few months, he and I became emotionally, physically, mentally, and spiritually very, very sick. And for him, it was very quick. And within a short time, he got up one morning and said, I can't urinate. And I literally picked him up and put him in the car and took him to the hospital. And they came out and they said, your husband's going to die, and he's going to die real soon. And he did. We were only married just a little over 2 years. I always felt it was just a case of two people who felt very sorry for each other. He had rescued me from a bad situation, and at least he did die sober, even though he never found the program of AA again. And he was always so afraid he'd end up in some little alley someplace drunk. So the personnel manager came out and he said, I know you don't have any family here. You see, I was living someplace where I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any family. It was the first time in my life I'd ever been away from them. And he said, I got an opening in a little town down in Clarksville, Indiana. And some of the people I met, I saw them yesterday. Are they here this morning? Okay. That I met down there when I moved there. And I started to, my ex-husband and the kids moved me down there, and I made contact with AA, and I started to go to meetings. I drank till I got there, but as I told you, the seizures had gotten so bad, and I was having so much trouble walking. And I went to a meeting one night, and the next morning, the lady called me, and she said, I saw you last night at the meeting, and I was so worried about you. She said, are you all right? And I said, no, I don't think I am. And I needed to work. He left me pretty in debt with his hospital and burial expenses. And she said, well, let me come over and talk to you. And she did, and when she got there, she said, you know, in AA, we can tell you how we got sober, but sometimes I think you need other help, and I think you need some medical help. She said, let me call the Jeffersonville Mental Health. And I said, but I don't have any insurance. It's been canceled. And she said, that's okay. They're based on your income. So she came that day, and she made the arrangements, and as we were going over there, I said to her, because I didn't know that lady, I wouldn't know who she was this morning. And I said to her, but why are you doing this for me? You don't even know me. And she said something to me that I have never forgotten. She said, because I used to be like you, and somebody came and helped me. So we went, and they put me on the medical side, said I'd injured my central nervous system with the alcohol and Ambien. And anybody that knows me, man, if you drop something, I'll jump 10 foot off the ground. I mean, that part of me never got well. But it was to become my awakening in that little clinic down there. Because, you know, even though I was hopeless, helpless, I wasn't hopeless. And maybe my life could get worse, but I could still always get better. And that for some of us, you know, maybe we may have one more drunk in us, but we may never get another recovery. My ex-husband started to come and see me and bring our son, and it was nice to be on good terms with him. I got me a sponsor, a lady, and I got a roommate. Her name was Roberta, and we were going to meetings, and I was doing things I'd never done in AA before. I was chairing meetings and giving little leads, and my ex-husband and I were sort of dating, but I still kept thinking about drinking. And you know when you get that stinking thinking, what happens? So one night after work, I thought, well, I'll just stop and get me a little six-pack and a little half pint, and I'll drink that. And well, of course, I drank that, and I was back into my old habits. I put on my clothes and went back out, went down the road to the nearest bar, which was a Holiday Inn. Some people came in there I worked with, and we sat there and drank, and they said, come and go with us over to Louisville. So I did. And, of course, you know what happened. I got drunk that night. Well, I didn't want any of my family to know where I was at, so I called this roommate up. And I said, Roberta, I'm okay. And I hung up. Well, she was scared to death. So she called my sponsor. My sponsor called my sister in Indianapolis. My sister called my ex-husband. And all of them called the police. They were sure I had been abducted. They went to the Holiday Inn and searched it, and they searched my car. And, you know, we come to AA being wanted. I was wanted in Indiana and Kentucky, Ohio. Well, the next morning when I got home, my sponsor was waiting there. And I started to cry. And she said, do what you did before. Go to meetings. Read the big book and don't take that first drink. And that was August the 20th of 1977, and thus far I haven't been back out. But, you know, there was more than just going to meetings, reading the book, and I was sober about 20 months at that time. And after 20 months, I knew I'd had all I could stand, all the confusion, everything was right back where I left off, you know, and I knew I'd had all I could stand. It's like my friend Bruce from Nebraska said, it's like the cat making love to the skunk. He knew he wanted more, but he had all he could stand. And one time in Cincinnati, I said that about, had all I could, after 20 months, I'd had all I could stand. These girls sitting down here laughing told me later, I told them, after 20 men, I'd had all I could stand. I had addictions, but that wasn't one of them. But it was just like before. All the confusion, everybody was calling each other. And, you know, Jim and I had been in AA. We knew. We'd been told what would happen to us if we drank, that we'd either end up in a mental ward or jail or dead. And all those things did happen to us. If, you know, they tell us if we don't sober up, we're going to get locked up or covered up. And that's just exactly what happened. And when I went to Oregon and New Jersey and came back to Indiana, I took my disease with me. But I had to become willing. I had to become willing to come to this program and to do the things that they told me. And most of all, I think I had to let go of all these old ideas because I had blamed everybody. I had blamed my mother. I had blamed my father. I had blamed these husbands. I had blamed this guy. It was always somebody else's fault. But as I said, when I went to these places, I took my disease with me. And, you know, Bill W., one of our founders, says in one of his writings, he says, intellectually I could accept my situation. Emotionally I could not. That our recovery is not dependent upon other people, but rather upon our relationship with God. And I'd had a relationship with God as a child. When Grandma and I, we always got down next to the bed and said our little prayers every night. But somewhere along in my alcoholism, I had gotten away from that. And in the 12 and 12, it talks about that we often return to the God of our childhood. And, you know, I tell newcomers, you know, we all have our setbacks, and if you're not the one that's close to God, He didn't move away. And in AA, we have three conceptions of God: those who believe in God, and those who don't, and then those who think they are God. Bet you don't have any of them, do you? At that time, we had a little study group of about five of us, and it said in the book that we should suggest maybe take the third step like we do our fourth and fifth step with another person. So I called the nuns in my parish, and I went over and I got down on my knees, and we said the third step prayer together, and I shared some things. And she said, "Liz, think of the bad times as the good Fridays of your life, and think of the good things in your life as the Easter of your life, a new beginning, a new start." And I said, "Sister, I feel like I do this, you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to Jericho." She said, "That's the key word, that you feel. That means that you're making the effort." And she said, "Make yourself a gift list, and on that list, put the gifts that God has given you, like your sense of humor and the ability to laugh at yourself." And she said, "These are gifts that God has given you." And, you know, we talk about prayer and meetings, and one night I heard a guy said he didn't believe prayers were answered, and I asked him, "How often you pray?" And he said, "I don't." And I said, "Well, how do you expect your prayers to be answered if you don't pray?" And the other night, Friday night, when Jim talked about the drunk prayers, and I said those drunk prayers, and "Please, God, send me some help, and please help me get sober." And I've never apologized for those prayers, because, you see, they were answered. And I'm here, and I'm sober this morning. And the prayers that we say, you know, at that moment of silence for the alcoholic who's still suffering, I've often felt those prayers were being sent for me. And we don't have to be the newcomer to be struggling and having things going on in our life in this program. So I'm very grateful for those prayers. And the prayers that my sister and others have said, I was asked to speak, I think it was up in Anderson several years ago, at an Al-Anon convention. And I was the AA speaker. And I took an Al-Anon friend of mine with me. And she said, "Well, Liz, how will they ever identify with you?" And I said, "Well, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm in a little group or a big group, that when I look out into the audience, and, you know, there's very few of you out there that haven't cried or been lonely and had some struggle in alcohol, either your own or somebody else's." And my dear friend Jack Sullivan, and I met Jack when I lived down there in Clarksville, and I used to go to the Thursday night meeting, and Jack came over to our meeting a lot, and he and I continued our friendship up until he died years ago. And I probably heard Jack speak over 20 times, and in every lead he always told, and Jack wasn't married during the years he drank, and he talked about how he lived in a cardboard box on Skid Row. And he said, "But, you know, I don't think I'm near as bad as all the rest of you who go out and drag your Skid Rows home with you and make your families live in it with you." And that's so true, that the people we love the most, we drag it home and make them live in this garbage with us. And, you know, there's been times in these last 23 years that a thought of a drink might cross over my head. But it's like a bird might land on my head, but I don't have to let her stay there and build a nest. And, you know, my serenity truly is my emotional sobriety. But it's something I have to work on, and I have to work on it on a daily basis. And it's like a swan, you know, smoothly across the pond, but you know underneath he's babbling like hell. And I do feel like that my life is the gift from God, and what I do with this life is my gift to God. And we don't grow out of the bad things, good things that happen to us, but rather out of the bad things. And I may not be responsible for my disease, but I am responsible for my recovery. Well, I moved back to Indianapolis, and we married my ex-husband. This is a wee one. lot of you know Clarence. Clarence is an alcoholic. He just don't go to meetings. He stopped drinking long before I did. I called my son up in Oregon, said, Dad and I are going to get we married. And he said, Mom, you tell Dad that this time if it don't work out, he gets the kids and the furniture. But last October, we were married 23 years. We had been married about 12 years and almost divorced that long. You know, he had his chance. But it's been a good marriage. We know what it's like to have a good marriage, and we know what it's like to have a bad marriage. And about 22 years ago, he retired from the police department. We moved down to a little lake outside of Greensburg, and I was the office secretary there at the lake, and he worked for the post office. We did move from the lake a few years ago, but we lived down there a long time, and I became very involved in AA and in service work. And, you know, they tell us if we don't want to fall off the wagon that we have to get in the middle of it, and I did. I got involved in the intergroup, and I've served as every office in the intergroup, and also I've been in GSR and DCM, and I've been involved in this committee a lot for the state convention. And but the most important thing in my sobriety is without a doubt my home group, and it's the St. Morris group. And as I told you earlier, for 22 years it's been there. And the people there, if they don't call me, it's, you know, daily, at least they call me weekly, and I've learned to lean on them, and their support has meant so much to me. A few years ago, Clarence started experiencing a lot of throat trouble, and he went to the doctor, and they determined he had throat cancer, and he had to have his voice box removed. And that summer, while he was recuperating, I was chairing a meeting at our Southeast Indiana conference, and people were asking me about him. So I attempted to tell this little story about him. And I said that the doctor told me that I should go and buy him a vaporizer, and I should run this vaporizer so he can have all this warm, moist air for his throat. And so I said, I went in the bedroom, and he's going, and he said, what are you trying to do, kill me? The paper was coming down from the wall. And I told the doctor this. And he said, I don't mean in the middle of July. I mean in the wintertime. Don't mind. Well, I didn't say. I said that the doctor told me to go and buy him a vibrator. Well, he had a vibrator he used to hold up to his throat to talk with. He doesn't use that anymore. And we had gone down to Myrtle Beach to a conference. And he always put that vibrator in my purse. And we had gone in to buy, he'd gone out to pump the gas. And I went in to pay for it. And I laid it down on the counter and went, and this girl behind the counter went, what is that? And I said, it's a vibrator. And about that time, he was in there, and it did it again. And I said, it belongs to him. So, that's the story of the vibrator. We donated that to the speech and hearing clinic in Decatur County. But at that same conference, there was a man from Indianapolis there, and he was just trying to be friendly to my husband. He said, how many years you been coming here? My husband went, he held up three fingers, and the guy said, I've been coming here. Guess he thought he couldn't hear me either. But we were preparing to go out to the international convention in Seattle, and we had our wounds and our registration, and this time he was diagnosed with colon cancer, and the prognosis was not very good. There's several people here that were up there that day, And he had surgery, and then it was followed by a year of chemotherapy. And at the end of the year, this nurse had become a good friend of ours. And so I had kind of like a little celebration plan. I bought a cake and a gift. But it wasn't a celebration that we had anticipated because the throat cancer had come back. And so we left that day, and we went over to Walmart. And I started to cry, and I said, I don't know where you get all your courage and all your strength. And he said, Liz, I just have to believe that when I turn my life over to these people, I'll make the right decision. And so we left there that day, and he went ahead and had more surgery and more radiation. And all my past leads, I've been able to say he's been in remission, but that situation has changed again. I talked about Jake earlier, and I always talk about Jake. From the first time I ever gave a lead, I talked about Jake, Jake's alcoholism and where it took him. And Jake had worked for the bakery in Annapolis, and he went to work there. He was 16 years old, and he drank a lot, and he smoked, and the bakery sent him to treatment. And they told him that if he had to go a second time, they'd fire him, and they did. And so he left, and he went down into the Carolinas and went to work down there. And he even got his hand caught in a slicer one time, and they had to reattach it. And my sister called, and she said, I think Jake's in kind of bad shape. He's had to have some surgery. He had to have the tip of his lung removed from working around the flour and the cigarettes and the drinking. So my husband took us down there to see him. And they brought him to our motel room. Jake was 52 years old. And I wasn't prepared for what I saw that morning. His fingernails had started to rot away, and he had this terrible death stare in his eyes, and he could no longer walk, and when he sat next to him so he could vomit there. And when he left, I called his doctor to see what the prognosis was. And she said, well, your brother's lung condition's under control, but he's killing himself with alcohol. And in the month to the day that we had gone down there to see Jake, he crawled up into the bathroom one more time to vomit, and they found him lying dead there in his vomit. I tried many times to help him. I called different intergroup offices. They made 12-step calls. And, you know, I can sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can have a stranger come in and sit down beside me, and maybe in some little way I can help him. But the people who are the closest to us sometimes are the hardest ones to reach out to. We brought Jake back, and we had a little service at the cemetery, and this daughter of his, who was too embarrassed to have him give her away at her wedding the year before, was running through the cemetery flying a kite. And someone said, why is Jenny flying that kite? And she said, because every spring my daddy told me he was going to come and fly a kite. So in some small way, maybe that was her closure. Sister Maurice from New York came and spoke at our annual fall feast one year. And Sister said that many of us are called to this disease, but few of us are given this gift of sobriety. But when we're given this gift, we're also given back our dignity. And for a lot of us, the only way we meet with God is eyeball to eyeball. And I guess that's the way it was with Jake. He just didn't want what we had. And I repeated this many times, but Larry Bird did an interview on a local TV station in Annapolis before he's the pacer coach. And he talked about his own dad, who was a chronic practicing alcoholic who committed suicide and left Larry's mother and these young children. And he said, some people make up their minds how they want to live their lives, and some people make up their minds how they want to die. And I guess that's what I would say about Jake. He made up his mind how he wanted to die. About 3 years ago, I was asked to do a 12-step call and it came through this hospice nurse. This chemotherapy nurse. She is now in charge of the hospice program in our county, and it came through my friend Sue, who has a treatment center in Rushville. And she called Sue and said that she had a patient. Of course, the hospice people were there taking care of her patient, but she needed somebody to go talk to the man's wife. She was drunk all the time, and they were afraid when he died she'd be drunk. So myself and Donna and several of the other ladies, we took turns going to see her. Well, oh, this lady was in bad shape. She shook so bad that I had her stand over a sink to smoke a cigarette. And she was hallucinating. She kept seeing these strings and paper clips hanging from the ceiling and on the floor, and she'd kick them out of the way when she walked. And I did what the old-timers did. I went and got some honey and orange juice and some vitamin B12, and we began to get her quieted down, and the hospice people were giving her a little alcohol from time to time to keep her from going into the DTs. And so I was to go back that evening at 9 o'clock and stay until 12. So I did, and by that time she was starting to sweat so bad. And so I laid her out on the bed, because I couldn't put her in the shower. She couldn't hold her still long enough. So I kind of gave her a little bed bath, and she began to quiet down. And she was a lovely lady. And she said, "You women have been so kind to me. Why are you doing this for me?" And I said to her what had been said to me so many years ago, "Because we used to be like you, and somebody came and helped us." She did manage to stay sober through the wake, and she drank again, but she just came to see me. It was last month. I do taxes sometimes for people, and she came to see me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that no matter what kind of mental or physical or emotional problems I might have, that I never have to get drunk again, that I never have to get drunk at anybody again. And when I was 5 years sober, one of the nuns in the parish called and said, "Would you teach a fourth grade religion class?" I said, "Can't you hear me saying Barabbas, Barabbas?" But I agreed to, and I did it for about 7 years, and it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. And I had a lot of cute little stories to share about the kids. Now, they were about 9, 10 years old, so one year I had like 10 in the class. Now, St. Morris is also my parish, and so it's just a little country parish, you know, out in the sticks and everything. And there were farm people, real farm people. And I had these little kids, and one year I had like 10 of them in the class. So I thought, well, I'll give each of them a commandment. And I told them to take that command, you know, draw it out, and take that commandment home and work that in your life for this week. And when you come back next week, I want you to tell me. So this one little kid, this one little boy, he said, I said, "Well, Bruce, how did you do?" And he said, "Well, I didn't commit adultery this week." And I said, "Well, that's good, Bruce." Bruce is about 22 years old now. I'd like to tell him that. And one time we had a priest that was in the program at that time, and I took the kids over to Oldenburg, and Oldenburg's a very historic Catholic, German Catholic community. And so Father was going to take us on a tour, and he was taking us through the church. And when we got there, the kids were following him, and I was behind him, and there were about 50 nuns in there, and he said, "Shh, the nuns are in prayer. They were reciting the rosary." So we just kind of went out and went outside the door. One kid said to Father, "They must really want to learn that prayer. They just said it over and over." But I did get a lot of satisfaction out of those years. I served on their Deanery Board of Education, and I served on the Finance Board, and I did the parish bookkeeping. And I always said, I don't tell you that to be boastful, because a lot of you are active in your communities, but only to show you that a woman who 5 years previously was in a straitjacket in a mental ward could come back and be a responsible, dependable person in my community. And I've been very grateful for those years. I hope all of you will bear with me. This past year and a half have not been very good for myself and my family health-wise. Started off in Kentucky at the state convention. We all went out to eat, and there's several of them here that saved me, I guess you'd say. I stepped off a curb and my feet went out from under me, and somebody stepped up behind me and caught me, so I didn't crack my head open, but I broke my ankle. And I was so insistent that night that I had to go. I came to hear Clancy, and I wanted to hear Clancy, and I hobbled down there to the meeting, and Chris couldn't stay, and Debbie, our taper, she took me back to my room, and the next day, my friends Ralph and Sue took me to the hospital, and I had to have my ankle set. So it made me kind of late having some things done. And one of the things I had to have done was a routine mammogram. And I went in and it was abnormal. And doctor said, there's something there that wasn't there last year. I want you to go back and get an ultrasound. And eventually she sent me in to get a biopsy. And it was malignant. And I had to go in and have the surgery. And then the couple of weeks after that, I had an upper respiratory infection. And I had to go in for an asthma attack, and followed by 6 to 7 weeks of radiation. And my sponsor called me, and she said, how you doing with all this? And I said, well, guess it means you're not going to get that job at Hooters. But you see, I've been here, and you told me that there's just nothing that you and me and this program and my higher power can't take care of. Last spring, my husband had to go back for a tonsillectomy, and they determined that throat cancer had come back again. And it was a very rare form. They had to take 17 biopsies before they could determine what kind it was. So past November, he started again with the chemo. And we had a little break in there, so we went to visit our son and moved to California. And while we were out there, my husband, some people leave their heart in San Francisco. He left his hair because all his hair fell out while we were there. And we came back home, and the day after we got home, he said, I want to talk to you. He said, I haven't been able to see out of my one eye since Thanksgiving. And you drove from the airport? And it's Irish pride. Well, I had to see if I could do it. But, of course, I called the doctor that moment, and I took him in, and they had an emergency operation. We took him in the access, and he had a detached retina. And they had to, normally they don't hospitalize you for it, but they did him because he was taking chemo, and they didn't, it's about a 100-mile round trip to take him up there, so they wanted to keep him very still. And during this, all this going on, our youngest son, Tim, called, and he said, Mom, doctor says I got some diseased tonsils, and I need to get a tonsillectomy. So will you come out and take me? So I did. Tim is 43 years old. He's never abused alcohol or tobacco. Doesn't use caffeine. He ran in the 500 marathon last spring. And he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And we were devastated. But you know, all the calls and all the cards and the prayers, and especially the prayers, is what has sustained us these past few months. And my nightly prayer was just giving me courage and strength. And I know it's working because there in November, I couldn't talk to anybody or walk into a room that I didn't break down or my husband didn't. And Tim opted for some pretty radical treatment. He would work every day until noon, and then he'd go and have his radiation, and in the afternoon he'd take a 3-hour chemo. And he did that for 5 weeks. And just kind of like in a holding pattern right now until next month. And my husband didn't come because he had a stern interstitial chemo last week, And he told Jerry, he gave him good instructions, and I'd take care of me. And what I said, especially the prayers. If someone said, well, that's the least I can do. No, that's the most that any of us can do, is the prayers. Because, you see, I know they're working in our lives. They tell us that we're human beings trying to be spiritual. But I think we were spiritual people just trying to be human. And, you know, when Floyd called and asked me to come and share, I'm sharing with the people who gave me back my family, my life, and my dignity. And I had a little prayer that I closed with, and a man told me, since I've been here, he says, you know, I love that little prayer. And a friend sent it to me. He said, dear God, thank you for all the things you have given me, for all the things you have taken away, and for all the things you have left me. And, you know, if nobody's told you they loved you this morning, you don't have to get drunk. Thank you.